the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program.
I have to be honest, that intro is really starting to grow on me. Friends and enemies, welcome to another episode of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast here on the CBP Media Network. My name is Joey. Len is off tonight. I'm doing an interview as usual, Wednesday night. We got Francis Puyo here, the founder of Bull Bitcoin and fashion icon. If you know, you know, the man with the vest, the man with the ideas, and I'm sure he's got a lot to say. So we're waiting for him to come to the green room. I'm sure he's busy, but as always, we'll start the show the same way as we always do with the sponsors. EasyDNS, best way for you, Anon, to become uncancelable, which is what you need to do, okay? Mark actually wrote a book called Unassailable, and it's sitting on my shelf here somewhere. I don't want to disturb the background there, but if you haven't read it, you should give it a go. I've started reading it, and EasyDNS helps you become unassailable, as is our guest tonight, actually, not willing to cancel or be canceled by anyone. So these guys are running a service over at EasyDNS that'll let you host, bring your content, do some file uploads. And actually we have a interesting announcement we're going to make, I think, on the Axis of Easy show that we're recording tomorrow about EasyDNS and Noster. So talk about true to the mission. You know, you already know they accept Bitcoin over there and have for a long time, but now that they're actually doing stuff with Noster, look out, man. These guys are a rocket ship. Another guy in the space once said, although I don't think I'll live to regret those words like Pomp did. So EasyDNS, of course, a great way to you know, host your stuff, man, and not get canceled. I'm waiting for Francis. I'm just talking to you guys in the chat. I see a lot of positive comments about Bull Bitcoin. And actually, I have since the Bull Bitcoin, I think it's basically a referral program, but it's a little more focused than referral programs we've seen in the past. The mission, destroy fiat. This came with the Madex t-shirts that I bought a few weeks ago. And I got a lot of these stickers now that I got to find a place for in the background here as I come up with something a little more permanent than just a bookshelf that was sitting around my house and the books that, you know, may or may not be related to Bitcoin. But they got a lot going on over there, Bull. We're going to talk about that. We're going to do some stuff about wartime Bitcoin, sort of in the same vein as a talk Francis was a part of over the summer. And then I also want to talk about the remnant stuff that's been going on over there with Francis. Lots to discuss, man. He's an interesting character, and he's been around Bitcoin for a very, very long time. Bull has a lot of great programs, like the DCA program that Paulie's mentioning in the chat, where, by the way, you know, I don't know exactly the technicals, but we'll talk about that tonight. They actually have an automatic coin join when you buy and send out. So we've had, obviously, Bitcoin Well, Dave Bradley on the show, and Adam as well. And they do buy and send, but Bull will actually do buy, mix, send. So pretty cool. I see Francis in the green room right now. I'm going to bring him in. Here he comes. Sir, thank you for making time today. Oh, look at that. I actually just showed the sticker. Same thing that's on your shirt. Same thing that's behind me here. You guys have maybe, I don't know, are you the best brand in the business, you think, because of Madex? You might.
No, we have the absolute best brand. Madex is a genius.
Absolute legend. So
yeah.
Francis, before we get started, first of all, how are you and where are you, buddy?
I'm doing great. I'm actually in Costa Rica, in the Bitcoin jungle, as it's called. Super cool area of the world where there's like hundreds of merchants that accept Bitcoin. It's actually where the Noster conference is being held this weekend as well.
Nice. I know there's a lot of good Bitcoiners headed over there this weekend. I'm looking forward to hearing what happens over there.
Over
the days. So let's get the boring stuff out of the way first, okay?
Yeah.
Who are you? Where did you come from? Why are you in Bitcoin? How'd you get into Bitcoin? We got to ask. I know a lot of people know, but we got to ask. How did it all get started?
Yeah, I'm gonna try to do this fast because, you know, it's a long story. I'm Canadian. I'm from Montreal originally, so I'm appropriate to have on this podcast. I was born in Montreal, and you know, went to college, high school, university, worked in Montreal my whole life. I got into Bitcoin pretty much 10 years ago today, like, you know, something like February 2013. I got into Bitcoin strictly from like being a libertarian. I got in from the libertarian side. So I was already pretty like into Austrian economics. You know, I was aware of Friedrich Hayek, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard. I got really into the Ron Paul presidential run. So like in 2012, like Ron Paul was running for president and he was, you know, a big libertarian candidate, and he was, you know, popular amongst people my age. That was like, I don't know, like 21 or 22 at the time. So I became a libertarian first. I hooked up with a bunch of very hardcore, like anarcho-capitalist libertarian guys from Montreal. We became friends, and just turns out that they were all like Bitcoin OGs. I mean, people think I'm an OG, but these guys were super OG, like 2010, 2011 OGs. And these guys started a group slash like physical space called the Bitcoin Embassy in Montreal. That's a super long story, but to make it very short, like these guys were into Bitcoin. And at the time, Bitcoin was super low profile. Like you didn't know anyone in real life who was in Bitcoin. There's probably like 10,000 people on the planet that were into Bitcoin, you know, so very, very niche. And then these guys were like, fuck, Bitcoin is going to become huge. It's going to become the next big thing. And we want to be around Bitcoiners. We want to be surrounded by Bitcoiners. Fuck the normies. Like, let's just create our own little space. So they created a physical co-working space, event space, informational space, like office space. It was big. I mean, it was like a 4-story, 12,000 square foot building, like downtown Montreal. The building was donated also by a early Bitcoin adopter that was, we all met on like the BitcoinTalk.org forum. So anyway, these guys launched a Bitcoin embassy, and, I was working, kind of in public relations, public advocacy, politics, lobbying, that kind of stuff. And they asked me if I wanted to join the Bitcoin embassy as their kind of like head of public affairs. So kind of like what some people are doing today, like lobbying the US Senate and going on spaces and talking to the media, you know, kind of like what Nick Carter is doing. You know, he's always on TV explaining Bitcoin and he's writing these policy reports on Bitcoin and energy and that kind of stuff. So I was doing that kind of stuff in Canada. So that's how I got in. I was a libertarian and my libertarian friends launched a Bitcoin embassy, and they asked me to join them. When I joined the Bitcoin embassy, I actually did not understand Bitcoin that much, how it worked. But what I understood was that it was going to end the state. And that was really all that mattered to me. I was already like a big libertarian, and I was looking at politics and I was involved in the libertarian movement politically. And I just could not see any political way out of the culture becoming degenerate, the government becoming bigger and bigger, our freedoms being eroded and being taken away from us. It's like a one-way street, you know? I don't know if you've noticed, like we never like gain more freedom over time. It's always like a little bit of freedom here, a little bit of freedom there. And it was like a one-way street. And it was like a slip. We were like on a slippery slope. You know, I felt like we were like, as a society, we're in this like quicksand being sucked in by a big government. And the root of our culture becoming degenerated, so, you know, mindlessly consumerism and very high time preference and the erosion of traditional moral values, you know, hysteria, fear of progress, you know, like this whole climate change thing, COVID thing ties into all this kind of like what I see as a like a degenerate culture and our erosion of freedoms. And the growing size of the state, I see all of that having the root cause being fiat money. So I got into Bitcoin on that basis. I was not a technologist when I first got in. I was really there to end the state. And I'm still there to end the state. But nowadays, I'm a little bit more into the technology as well.
Do you consider yourself a technologist now? And I ask because you guys over at Bull, like I was saying in sort of the lead up to you coming on the show, you guys over at Bull have a unique platform. We've had other platforms on here, Bitcoin Well, Dave Bradley and Adam, who you know well, I'm sure.
Yeah.
They do a similar thing to you, but you guys have this this mixing and kind of, you know, the batching and stuff like that, that I think a lot of companies are either not using or don't want to use. And I don't blame them, honestly, Francis. The pressure, as you mentioned, from governments as far as sort of oppressive anti-privacy, you know, the anti-privacy regime is expanding, as you said. And so tell me, first of all, about why CoinJoin? How confident or unconfident are you in that continuing to be part of the Bitcoin bull offering? And what would you say to people who are looking at the landscape and going, well, you know, there's other exchanges that might not coin join or do custodial, but it might be quote unquote safer to use those instead of using something like CoinJoin in every transaction that's clearly, if not in the crosshairs, at least on the minds of regulators?
Yeah, I'm gonna address CoinJoin right now, but I'm also gonna give like a little background on how we got to like CoinJoin, because like regular exchanges can't just like turn on CoinJoin because they don't have their own infrastructure. So there's a whole lead up to us building our whole like independent infrastructure that led to CoinJoin. But so Canada has some really good privacy laws. So there's something called the Canada Privacy Act, and there's a specific regulation called the Electronics Document Protection Act or something of that nature, which basically forces companies to protect their users' data. So in Canada, as a business, you're dealing with customers, you are not allowed to share the data of your clients with third parties without the consent of your users. So as an exchange, let's say that I'm doing bad privacy practices. So the worst privacy practice that you can do as an exchange is to reuse a deposit address. So imagine like you have an exchange, and every time you want to sell Bitcoin, you have to send Bitcoin to the same Bitcoin address. Overwhelming majority of exchanges do that. That is a terrible, terrible privacy practice. If the exchange is doing that, then anybody who's doing chain analysis on the blockchain will be able to, basically what the chain analysts or like the blockchain snoops are going to do is they're going to build what's called a cluster of addresses that belong to this exchange. So they're going to know, for example, all right, there's like this bunch of thousands of addresses. They belong to, let's say, Coinbase, for example. And they're watching those addresses. And every time someone sends Bitcoin to, you know, one of those addresses, they're going to be able to flag this transaction as being, all right, this person is sending money to Coinbase. And if the person who sends money to Coinbase sends money somewhere else, then the person who is receiving that payment is going to be able to know, oh, shit, the person who just sent me money is also a client of Coinbase. You're going to be able to make all of these links together. So if you're doing that practice of address reuse, you are telling the entire world that you have a business relationship with a customer. And not only that, people can reverse engineer how many Bitcoins that person is sending to the exchange. So you're leaking the fact that you have a business relationship with someone, how many transactions they're doing, how much volume they're doing, and also the size of their overall Bitcoin stash. If that person's not being very careful on their end with like managing their UTXOs, we call it, or like doing their own mixing, those bad practices by the exchange can actually lead third-party people, random people on the internet looking at the blockchain, from determining that a certain person has this amount of Bitcoins. That's very dangerous. That puts people at risk of $5 rent attacks, hacks, thefts, blackmail, all sorts of bad things. Again, also, the exchanges are basically receiving all these Bitcoins in their deposit addresses. They're putting them all into like one wallet, and they're making payouts from that wallet. So it's like really easy to track, okay, the money is coming from this user, it's going to Coinbase, for example, and then it's going out to another user. So when you're buying Bitcoin from one of those exchanges, similarly to sending Bitcoin to a reusable deposit address, everybody that then you spend that Bitcoin to will know that you bought Bitcoin on Coinbase. And they're also going to be able to reverse engineer how much you bought and how much you have in your wallet. So that's why, you know, often you'll see like on Twitter, like people are like monitoring the movement of money to and from an exchange. That's because these exchanges have really bad privacy practices. So there's two reasons why Bull Bitcoin does CoinJoin. So obviously we do reusable deposit addresses. We've been doing this since, non-reusable deposit addresses. We've been doing this since we launched, you know, in 2013. The CoinJoin we launched in 2019. So we do this for two reasons. First of all, it prevents people from tracking our users to Bull Bitcoin. When you're selling Bitcoin on Bull Bitcoin, because every coin that we receive, they're not aggregated. They're not mixed together. They're not like we call them aggregated in the Bitcoin lingo. There's no coin aggregation. They go straight into a mixer. Nobody is able to paint a picture, a cluster, a wallet cluster of what is Bull Bitcoin's wallet. So nobody knows how many Bitcoins are in Bull Bitcoin's wallet. Nobody knows how many transactions Bull Bitcoin is doing, how much volume we're doing. And if you're following someone and they end up selling their coins on Bull Bitcoin, it's just going to look like they sent Bitcoin to a mixer. So a third party is not going to be able to tell that someone is using Bull Bitcoin by using chain analysis. And I do this because I protect my user from accidentally revealing to the entire world that he's one of my clients, because that's confidential information that nobody else needs to know about. And also, I don't want other exchanges reverse engineering my volumes. I don't want other exchanges to know who my clients are. For example, let's say that, I'm Coinbase, and I'm monitoring one of my users, and I know that as Coinbase, I could know, for example, that one of my users is also a user of Bull Bitcoin. So I don't want other exchanges to do like corporate espionage, you know, and figure out who's Bull Bitcoin's clients are, what deals I'm doing, what volumes I'm moving. So I'm protecting the exchange from people knowing who we're dealing with, and I'm protecting our users from telling the entire world accidentally that they're dealing with us. And in terms of regulation, like CoinJoin is 100% legal. Not only is it legal to do CoinJoin and to do what we do, but my position is actually that we are obligated by law to do it. As I mentioned a bit earlier, there is the Canadian privacy laws that prevent us from leaking this information. So because we do CoinJoin and we generate new deposit addresses, I think we're actually being in compliance with Canada's privacy laws. So we haven't had any pushback really from doing CoinJoin. There's like one bank, a small bank in Canada that I'm not going to name, but it's so small that it's inconsequential. It's like one of those really small credit unions. They've actually blocked some of their users from sending funds to Bull Bitcoin because we're doing CoinJoin. So there is a little drawback there. But other than that, I mean, we've been doing it for almost 4 years and we've had no pushback. So I'm pretty confident that the CoinJoin is going to stay.
A badge of honor, I would say. And I got to be honest, Francis, I love that take. I've heard you say that before and I'm glad you said it tonight, because I think that you do have a responsibility to your users. Yeah. that I got to be honest, you know, some of the other exchanges are not fulfilling. Now, I'll ask you next, you know, I'm almost afraid to ask, but I will, because I'm sure you'll have an answer and I'm sure you've given this some thought. What are the big reasons for the other exchanges not doing that, knowing that the dangers exist and that they're becoming more prevalent? More and more people are kind of becoming competent in this sort of analysis. So why aren't they doing it?
So the first reason is that they physically cannot, right? And the reason why they physically cannot is that they don't own the Bitcoin infrastructure. They don't own the Bitcoin wallets that they are themselves using. Okay. So as an exchange, you're receiving payments, you're making payments. And obviously, we're not doing this from a mobile wallet. We're not doing this using, you know, a desktop like wallet like Sparrow, Bitcoin Core, Sparrow or Wasabi wallet. You need to have like enterprise grade software that your software will connect to. So you're building an app. Your app needs to connect to a Bitcoin wallet and programmatically make payments and receive payments. This is hard to do. It's very difficult to do. There's very, very few companies that I know that have done this. Bull Bitcoin has done it. River has done it in the United States. And Cash App has done it also in the United States. Bitnob has done it, an exchange in Nigeria. And these are the three only other companies outside of Bull Bitcoin that I know that completely own their Bitcoin infrastructure. Other companies, you know, ShakePay uses Coinbase very famously. Swan uses a company called Prime Trust. So does Amber, so does Strike, so does a bunch of people. A lot of other companies use a company called BitGo. So these companies, they're like Bitcoin custodians and hot wallets that specifically serve exchanges. This is how Bull Bitcoin started out in the early, and it's just really hard to do, right? It's hard to do right. Because if you are using your own Bitcoin wallet infrastructure, you are responsible for the security of your funds. You need to have your own engineers, and you need to really be a Bitcoiner and understand what you're doing. If you're just like a finance bro and you're launching an exchange, you don't want to have to play with Bitcoin wallets and develop your own wallet architecture and hire Bitcoin engineers. And there's all sorts of weird intricacies with Bitcoin. Like, you know, an exchange is going to do like thousands of transactions per day. I mean, tens of thousands. Some exchanges are probably doing 100,000 transactions per day. And, you know, you want to have 100% success rate on all of these transactions, because if I'm a user and I'm withdrawing Bitcoin from an exchange and the Bitcoin transaction doesn't work, like, that's a catastrophe for me as a user. I'm freaking out. I'm calling the exchange. I'm posting on Twitter. It's not supposed to happen. So you need to have like 100% of all the Bitcoin transactions you do have to go through. You need to manage fees. You need to manage like RBF transactions. You need to manage all sorts of weird things. So it's hard. The reason why we did it is that's kind of like a little bit of a historical context. When I first started doing Bull Bitcoin, and we launched in 2013 with a company called Bills, but we really started to ramp up like in 2016. I was using two centralized wallet services. One of them was kind of like a block explorer. So that's a service that when I receive a payment, I receive a notification from a Bitcoin node that's not mine, that's telling my app, hey, like, you know, you've received a Bitcoin deposit. I was using something called BlockCypher at the time. I don't think it exists anymore. And when a user wanted to, you know, buy Bitcoin and we wanted to send Bitcoin, I was using a enterprise wallet system called BitGo. So Bull Bitcoin was not like custodying its own funds and was not running its own nodes. We were using someone else's node and someone else's wallet infrastructure. And what happened is that there was something called the fork wars that happened, where a bunch of the Bitcoin businesses, the big ones, wanted to fork Bitcoin. They wanted to change the rules of Bitcoin to increase the size of the Bitcoin blocks. I'm gonna make this very long story very, very short. And it just so happens that the two businesses that I was using, BlockCypher and BitGo, were part of this coalition of businesses that wanted to change the rules of Bitcoin. And I'm like, wait a minute, if I'm using you and you are opting into this kind of like fork of Bitcoin, that means that as a business, as by default, I have to follow whatever decision you're making. Right. And I'm like, wait a second, like, this is not Bitcoin. Like, I'm supposed to be deciding what rules of I'm following, and I'm supposed to be custodying my own Bitcoins. So, and I was also part of the opposition of this group, the SegWit group, you know, the UASF group. I know these are like really niche terms. If you're like a hardcore Bitcoiner that knows Bitcoin history, this is very familiar, but otherwise you're going to be very confused. But I was part of another group.
If you're like class of 2017, you've heard UASF, like user activated right. software, you know, the SegWit, you maybe have read Block Size yeah. Wars or know about Block Size Wars. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was fully in that camp. And I wanted to run a UASF node as a business so that if ever there was a split, I would consider the SegWit, you know, chain to be the real Bitcoin and not the bigger blockchain, the bigger blockchain, actually. So in order to do that, I had to develop the node software and the wallet software to be able to do that. At the time, and this was like 6 years ago, there was nothing like Umbrel or Mynode or Embassy Start9. We only had Bitcoin Core. So I hired an engineer that's still working with us today, a guy called Kekski, and we built an open source project called CypherNode. And CypherNode is basically the open source alternative to the third-party companies like Coinbase, PrimeTrust, BitGo, or BlockCypher. So anybody can run this, by the way. Any Bitcoin company can run their own version of CypherNode. It's kind of like BTC Pay Server for merchants. You know, a lot of merchants will use BTC Pay Server as a self-hosted alternative to a payment processor like, you know, OpenNode or BitPay. A Bitcoin exchange would use CypherNode in the same kind of manner. So CypherNode and BTC Pay are similar projects. But BTC Pay is really for merchants and CypherNode is really for exchanges. So because we run CypherNode, like our whole Wasabi and CoinJoin implementation is within CypherNode. So to make the long story short, if you're using someone else's wallet infrastructure, you can't just ask them to do CoinJoin. You know, you got to do with whatever they're doing. And the other part of it is also exchanges. The people running exchanges are generally pussies. They're very, very cowardly people. Some of them have, you know, Bitcoiner ethics deep down, but really they don't want to take any risks, and they don't want to jeopardize. And they also have investors, you know. First of all, that's another topic. Like, Bull Bitcoin does not have any investors. So how are we funded? Well, I got into Bitcoin early. I was lucky enough. So I made money. You know, I bought Bitcoins when they were cheap. So I was able to accumulate some capital that today I can, you know, deploy. The Bitcoins that I bought 10 years ago are obviously worth a lot more. But also, when we launched Build and Bull Bitcoin, I already had a lot of clients. Like, we were a profitable, I mean, we were an income generating business, like, right from the start. So we are financed by the fees that we charge. And when the fees aren't enough, you know, we use, you know, my strategic Bitcoin reserve to finance the salaries of, you know, developers and staff and so on and so forth. So because we don't have investors, like, I can do whatever the fuck I want. You know, I can offer no KYC Bitcoin selling. I can offer CoinJoin. I can spend ridiculous amounts of money developing Lightning Network solutions. You know, for example, Lightning Network, why don't exchanges integrate Lightning Network generally? Well, you know, 3% of our transaction volume is Lightning Network, but 50% of our engineering efforts are Lightning Network. You know, 25% of the problems that we have with transactions not working, you know, and customer support related tickets might be Lightning Network. And then you have to, you know, put a lot of your liquidity, your Bitcoins in Lightning channels, and then they're stuck there. You can't spend them. It's kind of like, it's a decision that a VC would be like, why the fuck are you spending all that money on Lightning Network? Because it's not providing us a lot of ROI. And then, you know, I would say, well, because I want to be on the frontier of this technology, you know, I want to help develop the Lightning Network. I want to make the Lightning Network a real thing. If Lightning Network doesn't work, then Bull Bitcoin disappears. You know, if we don't have a transactional payment system that can scale, and if it costs me $50 to do Bitcoin withdrawals, and if it costs the user $50 to pay their bill in a non-custodial way, because we're a non-custodial exchange, right? So every transaction that we're doing, every trade that we're doing with the user is a transaction. So if the transaction fees on Bitcoin become too high, and there's not something like Lightning Network, then the non-custodial business model is just going to go out of business. But companies that have VC investors, they can't afford to put all that money into R&D. Same thing with CoinJoin, you know. Even though I have a pretty good argument for CoinJoin, and I think it's legal, I think it's okay, I took a risk. Another exchange, the investors are going to be like, what? You're going to launch into coin mixing? Like, fuck this. We're going to fire the CEO and put someone else in charge that's not going to risk our entire business being investigated by some government or something like that. So there's, just to summarize, there's two reasons why we have cool tech. One is because we have our own infrastructure, and we can play with Bitcoin in any way we want. And two, we are self-financed, so we don't answer to anyone else.
So a couple of things that you said that we'll pull on a little bit here. You mentioned that you want Bull to kind of be on the bleeding edge of this, and you've taken some risks in the past. And so far, Francis, I mean, it's hard to argue that they've paid off. Bull is widely regarded as sort of the cypherpunk exchange of choice, at least for Canadians. I mean, we've had exchanges mm-hmm. sponsor the show and come on the show, of course. And, you know, a lot of people ask for you guys and you specifically. So you're doing something right there. The question I have for you, and you've mentioned kind of the influence governments have or don't have, should have or shouldn't have. You know, when you think about, you know, what Bull and Bitcoin in general can do to kind of push the message forward. You said that there's some people who are lobbying or participating in political action committees mm-hmm. and things of this nature. Do you view that as a valid way to spend resources? It sounds like maybe you don't, and I'm curious about why or why not that's the case.
I mean, I do think there's some validity in it. I mean, I did it between 2013 and 2016. A bulk of my time was to deal with regulatory agencies, specifically in Canada. I dealt with the Senate of Canada's Banking Committee, the Ministry of Finance, FINTRAC. FINTRAC is the regulator that does the KYC AML rules for, you know, Bitcoin and other types of businesses. I dealt with the Ontario Securities Commission and the AMF in Quebec. And I was basically like an expert witness providing my testimony and advice on what I think the Bitcoin regulations should be and pushing back on some of the frameworks that they wanted to implement. And the result of that, and it wasn't just me, but it was like six or seven people. You know, it wasn't a large group of people. We all knew each other, all Bitcoin OGs from Canada. And we got some pretty good regulations in Canada. So Canada has perhaps the best regulatory regime for Bitcoin of, you know, Western major countries that I know of. Some of the key points that we were pushing for was like, you don't need to do KYC under $1,000 per transaction. There's no reporting over $10,000 per day. There's no like specific license required to operate a Bitcoin exchange in Canada. Like most people don't know this, but you don't actually need a license in Canada to operate a Bitcoin exchange. You just need to register your company as being a Bitcoin exchange, but the government doesn't give you permission. You just basically tell them that you're going to do a Bitcoin exchange and then you comply with some of the regulations. So in our case, obviously I think that it was worth it. What I don't think is a good use of time is trying to convince governments that Bitcoin is good for the environment, that Bitcoin is good for them. I don't want governments to buy Bitcoin. I don't care if governments ban mining. If they ban mining, mining is just going to go somewhere else. The only kind of regulate like lobbying that I think is worth it is to try to, you know, minimize the KYC AML for exchanges. I think that's like a really impactful use of time. But other than that, like, you know, at this point also, the government cannot do much to stop Bitcoin. There's only one thing really that the government can do is it can prevent people from buying and selling Bitcoin on exchanges. It can increase the regulation on the exchanges. But to stop Bitcoin, you know, taking over mining or preventing people from running their own nodes, preventing people from owning Bitcoin, that ship has just like sailed. So I think that, you know, Bitcoin is relatively safe from government, you know, attacks other than attacking the on-ramp and off-ramps, which is what, for example, they're doing in the United States. Like if you look at the United States regulation on the exchanges, it's insane. A self-funded cypherpunk company like Bull Bitcoin could never operate in the United States. I mean, just the legal costs of like, you know, a business like Swan or Coinbase, I mean, must be multiples of our entire budget. And the other thing that they could do is they could make those regulations so tight and so onerous that only very, very large centralized players, that are almost indistinguishable from banks could operate Bitcoin exchanges, but they could never stop like peer-to-peer trading, you know, and they can never stop mining. They can never stop running nodes or owning Bitcoin. That's just impossible at this point.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, you mentioned there are a couple of attack vectors. The exchanges is a popular one. You mentioned one earlier, and I'm going to go back to it here very quickly. Yeah. And you can tell me what you think about this. Yeah. This idea you can attack the protocol at the protocol rules level, changes to the code, changes to the to the nature of Bitcoin. There's been one, maybe not change, but, you know, at least something that has gotten people riled up, you included, me included, is this ordinals inscriptions thing. Now, I know what you think about ordinals already, and you can talk about it as well. But I'm curious, in your line of work, how much do those full blocks mean to a company like Bull Bitcoin and other exchanges too, I guess, Francis? And like, you know, I personally wouldn't have a problem with full blocks if they're monetary transactions. Mm-hmm. But when I look at the ordinals and inscriptions thing, you know, I don't see a lot of monetary value there. There may be some other value down the road, but right now it's sort of a dumb way to fill blocks in my view. I think you share the same view, but what does it mean for a company like Bull when that's the case? Like the fees go up, the service sort of standard suffers. What's that about?
Yeah. So, I mean, running a node itself, it becomes more difficult to run a node itself, but running a node is like our core business. Like I have like professional engineers that are running enterprise grade full nodes. So the cost of running the node itself is not that much of an issue. Whereas, you know, for like the average Joe, running a full node will become much more difficult. They have less resources and less expertise to do that. But realistically, the fees go up and the confirmation times go down. well, the confirmation time goes up, sorry, the speed of confirmation goes down. So that is something that's inevitable. That was always going to happen. So I always planned for Bitcoin fees to go up. That's why we do the transaction batching stuff. That's why we have Lightning Network. That's why I integrated the Liquid Network, even though it's Liquid is like very not popular. Almost no one is using it. That's the reason why I built those integrations. So the major drawback is like, the fees go up. And as a non-custodial exchange, I pay fees for every transaction, every trade that happens, I have to pay fees. Most of the exchanges, the transaction fees of the Bitcoin network are not a huge part of their budget because, you know, when you withdraw from an exchange, they're usually not going to withdraw right away. They're going to put you in a queue and then, you know, they're going to do like one withdrawal a day. And a very small portion of the users actually withdraw their Bitcoins from the exchange. A user typically will do, you know, dozens, maybe hundreds of trades before for each deposit and each withdrawal. So it disproportionately affects the non-custodial exchanges for sure. So I planned for Bitcoin fees to go up and I don't mind paying Bitcoin fees, but I don't want to have to pay Bitcoin fees because people are putting fucking JPEGs on the blockchain. Like I didn't sign up for that. So the thing that's interesting about the ordinals is that it shows that there can be unintended consequences to seemingly technical changes that are unforeseen. So one of the reasons why ordinals is such a big deal, it is because when we changed the rules of Bitcoin to add SegWit, we did actually a political compromise, a trick, which was that some parts of the Bitcoin transaction, the SegWit part, was going to pay four times less fees than the regular part of the Bitcoin transaction as before. So if you're doing a SegWit transaction, you're paying four times less fees than a regular transaction. Even though you're using, you know, similar amounts of space ultimately. So there's kind of like a discount on SegWit transactions. And nobody could have foreseen in advance that people were going to abuse this to stalk arbitrary data in the SegWit portion of the transaction. So in hindsight, if I was going to redo it all over again, I would say, we're not going to put a fucking discount on SegWit transactions because that discount is going to be used for nefarious purposes. You know, this kind of stuff happened with Taproot. I'm not saying that Taproot was the cause of inscriptions. You could have done inscriptions and ordinals without Taproot, but people are using Taproot for that. I mean, the main use of Taproot today is JPEGs on the blockchain. Taproot was being advertised as a privacy enhancing technology. It was advertised as a more efficient way to do Bitcoin transactions. And what it ended up allowing was non-fungible sats, which are bad for privacy, and bloating the blockchain with JPEGs. I'm not saying we should remove Taproot. I'm just saying that it was pushed into Bitcoin very quickly. Well, not super quickly, but relatively quickly. And there were unintended consequences. So whenever I see people proposing new rules to Bitcoin, new scripts, new whatever it is that you can put into Bitcoin via soft fork, now I'm thinking, okay, there's a lot of unintended consequences that we know can happen. And even though the developers that are pushing for this change are telling us, no, there's no downside to this at all, we now know that there is potentially a downside to it. And all of these potential downsides, they kind of add up. You know, you can't, I think it's very hard to like destroy Bitcoin, but you can make tiny little compromises that add up over time. So now we have the SegWit discount, we have Taproot. Let's say that we add more more little things to Bitcoin, like over time, these will add up and maybe they will interact with each other and then someone will find a more major exploit in the future. I also think that a lot of people want to add stuff to Bitcoin because they think Bitcoin competes with Ethereum. They think like, well, you know, Ethereum is innovating and Ethereum has smart contracts and Monero has this kind of privacy transaction and this other blockchain has this type of feature. So if Bitcoin wants to compete with those other blockchains, it needs to keep up with the technology. And I don't think that's correct. I don't think Bitcoin competes with the other blockchains on a technological basis. I think Bitcoin competes with these blockchains for other reasons. because it's censorship resistant, because it's the most decentralized, because it has the immaculate conception. So the way that Bitcoin was created and the way that the Bitcoins were initially distributed through open mining is irreproducible. Bitcoin has the biggest network effect. The monetary policy of Bitcoin, the big advantage of Bitcoin is that people trust that the rules will not change. So, you know, if you compare Bitcoin to Ethereum, for example, basic comparison, when Ethereum first launched, a lot of people in my circles were excited about Ethereum and they were investing in the pre-sale. I did not invest in the pre-sale. Obviously, that was a bad financial decision. If I was only motivated by making more money, I would have invested in the Ethereum pre-sale. But one of the things that turned me off so much was that nobody could tell me what's going to be the monetary policy of Ethereum. And it seemed like the monetary policy of Ethereum was able to shift, and it has shifted over time. The monetary policy of Ethereum has shifted, I think, like 3 or 4 times. And there's no cap if Ethereum, for example, is so centralized, and it is centralized because the node is doing very complex things and is very heavy and it's very hard to run nodes. So you have like very, very few companies, like maybe 3 or 4 that are basically running nodes for the entire ecosystem. And you have this founder, Vitalik, and the Ethereum Foundation. So you have a group of like, let's say like 6 or 7 entities that can unilaterally change the rules of Ethereum. So if Ethereum wants to change, and they just did, right? They just switched from proof of work to proof of stake. So the value proposition of Bitcoin is not that it adapts to competition, is that it remains the same over time. I'm not a big fan of changing the rules of Bitcoin. I think that ordinals is not an existential threat to Bitcoin. I find it to be like more distasteful than anything else. It's more almost like an emotional thing where I don't want to have to store people's fucking garbage on my node. I think it's just distasteful. It does add a lot of externality costs to other people. Okay, so why are you running a node as a user? As a user of Bitcoin, you're running a node because you intend to receive payments. And when you receive a payment, you want to make sure that the money that you're receiving are actual legitimate Bitcoins. And the way that you do that is that you are able to track the trail of transactions all the way to the point that they were mined. So before I receive a Bitcoin transaction, I don't know which UTXO the person who is going to pay me is using. I only know the UTXO that the person is using after they send the money. Mm-hmm. So I need to keep a history of all the transactions, all the possible UTXOs that are out there, so that I'm able to verify any payment that comes in. So the cost of doing that is to have the storage and have the computational resources to do the validation of the blockchain. But the benefit is that I am able to validate that the money I'm receiving is good money. With ordinals and inscriptions, I am incurring a new cost, which is I'm storing all of these JPEGs on my node, but I'm not getting any new benefit as a Bitcoin user. I'm only getting downsides. So that's why it's bad. It's creating an imbalance of incentives. And the thing that's also kind of scary with this is, okay, so, and we're kind of diverting to ordinals a little bit, but like final thought on that is that, okay, so the ordinals are stored in the SegWit part of a Bitcoin transaction. And realistically, once you've downloaded the blockchain, you can discard that transaction data relatively safely. So you do what's called pruning. So you download the blockchain, you take all the SegWit part, and then you get rid of it. So you don't have to store it. Even though you still have to download it in the first place, you don't have to store it forever. But when you launch a new node, you have to download it the first time. And where do you download it from? You download it from another node. So if all of the nodes are getting rid of the SegWit portion of the transaction, they're pruning all their transactions, then what's going to happen is you might end up in a scenario where there's only a few nodes in the network that have kept that historical data and that are sending it to new nodes, and then they can fuck with you, right? And then if there's only like one node, you know, left that's storing the archive, that node can fuck with you. I'm a little worried about the way that Bitcoin upgrades generally. And the reason why it's worrying is that you have Bitcoin Core developers that are putting their changes into Bitcoin Core. That's typically how it works. you don't have to upgrade to Bitcoin Core to activate those changes. You are free to not upgrade. But the thing is, not upgrading to Bitcoin Core means that you're not benefiting from any kind of security patch or any kind of other related enhancement and optimization that Bitcoin Core provides. So you might say, well, why don't you just wrote another node that's not Bitcoin Core? Well, that's the problem. There is only Bitcoin Core on the market. Like 7 or 8% of all the Bitcoin nodes in the network are Bitcoin Core. There's a few other systems out there. So it's kind of like an opt-out system where it's like, all right, so we're putting this new feature in Bitcoin Core. And if you don't like it, then just opt out. But if you opt out, there's nothing to opt out to. So Bitcoin Core has like a de facto monopoly on the node market. And that's kind of a good thing. You know, you don't want to have multiple types of different nodes because you want all nodes to remain compatible. Like Bitcoin is all about every user being compatible with every other user. That's very, very important because if two nodes are not compatible, then you can have a blockchain split. Essentially, you can fork the network accidentally. So I have a few suggestions on how to upgrade Bitcoin in the future. And mostly it is to not put those new features in Bitcoin Core. So when you want to add a new feature to Bitcoin, you create a new node software, and the people that want to run this new node software, they opt into a separate software that's not Bitcoin Core. But the developers know that this is the best way to do this. The thing is, very, very few people are motivated enough to do that. So the developer mindset is, well, if we ask the user to opt in to this change instead of opting out, nobody's going to opt in. So Bitcoin is kind of like almost on an auto upgrade path right now, where updates are pushed to the main software and people just blindly update it. So that's kind of dangerous. I mean, of all the things that worry me about Bitcoin, this is the only true major risk that I see, is kind of like this culture of just updating to every new technology just because Bitcoin Core has a monopoly on the node software, because people trust the Bitcoin developers. The Bitcoin developers are also driven by reasons that are not just the welfare of Bitcoin. You know, adding a feature to Bitcoin as a Bitcoin developer, successfully including a modification to the rules that you want in Bitcoin, is like the pinnacle of your career as a Bitcoin developer. Like you have, your code is included in Satoshi's most amazing software project. It's every developer that's in Bitcoin Core or around this kind of ecosystem dreams of modifying Bitcoin and having their code run on everyone's node forever. So developers are kind of biased to want to include their own software in Bitcoin Core. And to be fair, I mean, some of these guys are working like 3-4 years full time on a change to Bitcoin, and they have every incentive to push for that change to happen. So Bitcoin is very hard to attack from the outside and very resistant to like a punch, you know, but a lot of tiny compromises that are coming from within the ecosystem, specifically Bitcoin Core, might add up over time to a critical flaw happening. And as well, Bitcoin is not vulnerable to government attacks, but a lot of compromises at the exchange level or wallet level might also cause problems in the long term. So for example, address reuse, you know, poor privacy practice. Bitcoin can be very private. It can be very fungible. If every single wallet and exchange was doing things right, was doing Bitcoin transactions the right way, managing their UTXOs, managing their addresses, and the way they make transactions correctly, Bitcoin would be very, very fungible. It would be very hard to track Bitcoins moving from one exchange to another. So at the protocol, Bitcoin has the potential to be as anonymous or fungible in practice as things like Monero. But in practice, because all of these exchanges make these bad design decisions, they do add up over time where, you know, a very large portion of transactions are happening between a few entities that have bad privacy practices. Therefore, the overwhelming majority of transactions on the network have bad privacy. And the crazy thing about also privacy is that if everybody else is doing bad privacy practices and basically doxing themselves, and you are doing good privacy practices, you have a risk of basically like revealing yourself, you know, you're standing out. So if you're using CoinJoin, for example, nowadays, you're kind of standing out. I don't know how many people are using CoinJoin, but I would say maybe like, I don't know, like 1% of Bitcoin users, something like that, you know? So if the government wants to like, you know, attack Bitcoin privacy, what they can do is they can go see the exchanges and be like, all right, well, just prevent anybody that's doing CoinJoin from using your exchange. Or ask extra KYC. I don't think that they're doing it yet, but they could do that. And if everybody was doing CoinJoin, the government couldn't do that, right? Because the exchanges would be like, well, you can't do that because all of our users are using CoinJoin. So we can't flag all of our users as being suspicious. We can't block all of our users from using our platform. But because only a small portion of Bitcoin users are using CoinJoin, then the exchanges don't really have that excuse. So it's really kind of like the culture of Bitcoin from within being complacent, being lazy, or being greedy, or being compromising that can ultimately lead to some flaws in Bitcoin in the future. So that's also the reason why the toxicity of Bitcoin maximalism and this kind of like outspoken, outrageous at times attitude on social media is important, because what we're trying to do with the toxic maximalist uncompromising stance is we're trying to create a culture, because Bitcoin is not just a tech project. Bitcoin is a cultural social project, and we all agree to certain rules, right? And we all use standards. We all adopt these methods of using the protocol. The way that we use Bitcoin is not coded in the white paper. It's embedded in the apps that we use every day, and it's embedded in the best practices that are being recommended by wallets as the default path for a new user. So the culture of Bitcoin is very, very important for the security of the protocol in the long term. So that's why a lot of people, they say like, but you guys are fucking outrageous. It's like, yeah, but we're trying to steer it in one direction. You know, we're having one extreme position at one end, but that's because we want to steer the entire culture in that direction. That's very, very important. You know, Bitcoin users are like the white blood cells of the body that is Bitcoin, you know? And Bitcoin is immune to disease because there are white blood cells. It's not, Bitcoin is not immune to attacks by the protocol. Bitcoin is immune to attacks because people are motivated to enforce certain ways to use Bitcoin for themselves and for others. So that kind of also ties into that. So that's why, you know, when I'm speaking about, you know, ordinals and inscriptions, I want the message to be that it is not okay. It's not an okay thing. It should be socially frowned upon to do that. If you're pushing for changes to Bitcoin recklessly, that's not an okay thing to do. I want there to be some kind of stigma around that culturally, so that people kind of like, you know, think twice about doing those things. It's easy for the Bitcoin culture to become corrupt and for us to make these little tiny compromises that, as I said before, will, I think one day could end up being like a fatal flaw in the network.
That might be the best 20 minutes I've ever done on this show. It might fucking be.
Thank you.
Chat loves it. That was unbelievable. We on the show talk about when the guests start rolling downhill. I've never seen anything like that. You're absolutely right. I don't disagree with anything you said there, man. That it's about does the change bring us closer to global base money, or does it bring us further away?
Yeah. And totally.
I think the answer there is obvious. I see it starting to rain there. I want to ask you one more question, and then I got a fun one to get you out of here on.
Yeah.
You may be the guy who invented the remnant thing in Bitcoin culture. Where did this come from? Why have you chosen this kind of banner to march under? Tell me a bit about that.
I was on a podcast with Pierre Rochard and Michael Goldstein, the Noted podcast.
Great show.
These are my two favorite influencers. You know, whenever I meet them, I'm just so happy. They are the guys whose early writings really influenced me. And Michael asked me, have you read this text, Francis, on the podcast, Isaiah's Job? And I said, no, I haven't. And I read the text, and Isaiah's Job is actually a very obscure kind of like essay written in like 19... fuck, I want to say like 35 or something, you know, 1940 or something. I can't remember. Very, very old. Where the author of that text is basically laying out the remnant kind of philosophy, talking about communism versus individualism, where the communist politicians are like appealing to the masses, but the masses do nothing. So there is an actual foundational text that I think everybody should read. It's a life-changing text. It's called Isaiah's Job, named after the prophet Isaiah in the Bible. But even before that, I had been focused on Bitcoin adoption since I got into Bitcoin. So I was Mr. Bitcoin adoption. So I was running Bitcoin education. I was kind of like doing, you know, what like BTC Sessions is doing today. You know, I was like trying to get everybody into Bitcoin, like what Swan is doing also, like really trying to educate the masses. And my initial philosophy was, if the more people we get into Bitcoin now, the less chance governments have to attack it while it's still in its infancy. So I wanted Bitcoin to become too big to fail really quickly, because in the early days of Bitcoin, I was really worried about like government attacks. But then I realized that it's not the quantity of Bitcoiners that matters. It's the quality of the Bitcoiners. And then I kind of started to shift my perspective, where it's like, I don't want to have as many Bitcoiners as possible. I want the Bitcoiners to be so radical and have so much skin in the game and even put their soul in this game and dedicate their entire lives to it, that it becomes a kind of like intolerant minority. There's also a related concept, the concept of intolerant minority, which was popularized by Nassim Taleb, which before he became a fucking moron on Twitter, actually wrote a lot of really great books. And this was a part of his book, Skin in the Game and Anti-Fragile. So the concept of the intolerant minority is that change is never brought upon by the masses. Change is brought upon by a small amount of people that simply refuse to do any compromise whatsoever. A good example of that is, you know, the American Revolution. You know, it's estimated that only 2% of Americans were part of the American Revolution or involved in the American Revolution. Yet, so the overwhelming majority of the masses in the United States did not revolt or want to revolt or participate in the revolt against the British. So it is a very, very motivated and hardcore minority of people that actually affect change. Another, you know, funny example of that is all of the orange juice in the US is kosher. Even though a very small part of Americans care about following a kosher diet, those who do care about so much that they will boycott your product if it's not kosher. So as a company producing orange juice, you're going to be like, well, you know, I'm going to for sure lose the kosher people if I don't make my orange juice kosher, and the masses don't care about being kosher. So I'm going to cater to, you know, the people who follow the kosher diet. So I also kind of saw that. So that's where the remnant ideology came from. There is a text called Isaiah's Job. It's also a text called The Intolerant Minority by Nassim Taleb. And then it all kind of came into focus in my mind. And also because over time, the longer you stay into Bitcoin, the more of a divide you see between the normies or the NPCs. I have a lot of friends that are normies and NPCs. I don't mean to say that they're like necessarily inferior people, but I think we all know what I'm talking about when we're talking about normies and NPCs, and the people who have like a moral fortitudes that are extremely self-aware, that are very conscious of their place in the universe, that value freedom and sovereignty, and that are, you know, that are actually moved, that are actually doing shit, that are actually producing, you know, for every person that is producing, you have like 30 people that are leeching off of him. And then the longer you stay in Bitcoin, the kind of like more of a divide you see between those two categories of people. And after a while, trust me, for those who have been in Bitcoin for more than like 4 or 5 years, you'll look around at your friends group and you'll be like, wow, I have a really different friends group. I value these people a lot more differently. So as I got into Bitcoin, I already started to see this kind of like divide. And with the lockdown and the pandemic and the COVID shit happening, I mean, then it became just like crystal clear. You know, it became like very, very, very evident that there is a large part of the population that is fully asleep. If you want to have any positive change, do not count on them. They will just disappoint you. There is nothing. They're unreliable. At best, they are spectators. At worst, they are direct threats to you and your family. So that's also where I became a little bit more radical, where so it's like, in the beginning, I was like, well, you know what? Like, all, you know, we Bitcoiners, like, let's just do our own thing and build our parallel society. And then, you know, eventually their society will crumble. But I didn't count on the masses turning on us in such a radical way. Yeah. You know, kind of like, you know, the Germans turned against the Jews, like, so quickly, you know, in like, I don't know, 8 to 10 years, you know, who could have predicted that? So my philosophy is really that we shouldn't really care what the masses think about Bitcoin too much. I don't want the masses to drive the design decisions of my app, for example. You know, it's kind of like what Henry Ford said, you know, if I let the masses decide what they wanted, they would have said, I want faster horses. So I don't want to cater to the masses. And in building Bull Bitcoin, I had a very, very deliberate plan. So as you mentioned earlier, I was Madex is my best friend in real life. I met him through Bitcoin, and I was working with Dave Bradley, also now at Bitcoin Well. And we were trying to come up with like the design philosophy of Bull Bitcoin. And we came up with essentially, we want to have the experience and the feature set and the mindset that the top 0.1% of Bitcoiners will fucking love. So if you put my app and another app in front of a normie, the normie might overwhelmingly pick the other app because it's what he wants. He doesn't want responsibility. He doesn't care about any of those things that I'm doing. You know, we have some crazy shit in Bitcoin that people don't know about. Like, all of our invoices are signed with PGP. They're timestamped using open timestamps. We have all sorts of other crazy shit that vast majority of people don't care about. But I don't care about pleasing the average person. I care about pleasing my fellow Bitcoin maximalists. And I don't want to adapt my design standards to the masses. I want the masses to adapt to my design standards. And this is what all great innovators have always done. You know, it's the same thing with electricity in the beginning. People didn't like the design of electricity. They didn't like the design of, you know, look at all those videos of people laughing at, you know, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates for like, nobody's going to use the fucking internet. Like, nobody's, this way too complicated, you know? And it's like, well, you know, at some point, the people who are using the compromised normie version of the app, they're just going to get wrecked. And via natural selection, people are just going to slowly make their way to Bull Bitcoin, you know, or some other thing. So the remnant kind of philosophy is also a product design philosophy, which is if you want to affect change, cater your, and that's what the text Isaiah's job is talking about. He says, the most important job of the prophet is to never compromise with the masses, never compromise your message, always cater to the remnant. And then the remnant will hear your message and they will disperse this message. And in our case, the message is like best practices and like wallet standards and like ways to operate a Bitcoin business, and they will spread it, you know, virally. So that kind of like ties into to all of that. And I mean, now I think if you read the remnant book, you'll see like the hardcore Bitcoin maximalists, like we are the remnant. I mean, it's pretty clear. And then our role, and I include you, Joey, and you know, I include in that our role of the prophets, you know, a few thousand people that are like the most active Bitcoiners you can get, you know, like the most radical, I dedicate my life to Bitcoin and that are maximalism. Like our role as prophets is to cater to the remnant and never dilute our message. So diluting your message is what the shitcoins do. You know, it's what the fiaters do. It's what politicians do. Politicians never stand behind their original ideals. They will always go after the median voter. And then what do we get? The fucking same old shit, you know? So yeah, that's my bit about the remnant.
Fucking killer. That's fucking killer. I got to be honest with you. It's a little bit biblical here. You're kind of glowing with the thunder behind you. Interesting. I don't know. Something to be said about that. Some divinity at play here.
Okay, Francis, yeah, maybe.
You've been very good. Last question.
Yeah.
Do you think – so we got a friend of yours coming on the show in the summer when his next project hits the pages. Do you think you could beat Alex Svetsky in a 40-yard foot race?
Oh, shit. Yes.
Ah.
Yes.
Yeah. Are we talking? Is it close or no? Like, what do you think?
You know, Alex and I have actually trained together quite a bit. We've never sprinted. Alex is in fucking shape, man. Yeah, he takes his health very seriously. But I mean, I also surf every day. I don't know. It would be tight. Yeah. Yeah. So Alex, you mentioned Alex. So Alex. The reason why me and Alex are like connected with this whole remnant also philosophy is like we bonded very, very closely during the whole lockdown. And we actually started to have like these private Telegram groups, you know, called the remnant, where we would, invite a few people because we didn't know who we could talk to, you know, like who's on the same page as us with the pandemic and the lockdowns. And so that's really cool. So Alex, I'm very happy that Alex kind of like, because I don't write that much. I used to write a lot, and I write a lot on Twitter. But Alex has been steadily putting the remnant concept into what's probably ending up a book at some point, I guess. At least it's a series of articles. So yeah, he has a 3-part series called We Are the Remnant. I think that's pretty good.
I got to look into all this remnant stuff for sure. Francis.
Isaiah's job. I'm going to say one more time. Everybody, your homework is to Google Isaiah's job.
Chat's buzzing. People love it. They're I'm sure you're going to get a lot of followers who want to talk to you about that. Your Telegram group is going to be full after this.
Awesome.
So look, tell people where they can find you. And if there's anything else you want to talk about before you go, it's all yours, man.
That's great, man. I love being in the podcast. It was a long time coming. I'm supposed to be at the Canadian Bitcoin Conference. I'm a speaker at the Canadian Bitcoin Conference in June. So, you know, if you want to meet me in person, I mean, I live in Costa Rica. I'm almost never in Canada. So it's going to be like your one and only chance, unless you come down to Costa Rica. If you do, send me a DM. You can also, if you're in Montreal, please, please sign up to the Montreal Bitcoin Meetup. It's fucking awesome. It's really, really cool. There's a bunch of Bitcoin meetups. Also, there's the Victoria Bitcoin Meetup. There's the Border City Bitcoin Meetup. There's always a bunch of bull Bitcoin people at those meetups. I'm on Twitter at Francis Pouliot _. I don't have a blue check, so you'll know I'm not a spammer by the fact that I don't have a blue check. And of course, check out bullbitcoin.com. And, Bull Bitcoin is known as a Bitcoin exchange, but not a lot of people know that you can actually pay your bills with Bitcoin. You can pay your credit card with Bitcoin. You can sell Bitcoin. And kind of the cool thing about our service is you don't have to do any KYC if you stick to under $1,000 per transaction and $10,000 per day. So if you're just like a regular pleb and you want to pay your credit card or you want to do a cash advance on your credit card against your cash with your Bitcoin, check out our service or bill payment service. I've been using it for since it launched in like 2013. I know a lot of my Bitcoiner friends, you know, they're able to live off of their Bitcoin. I don't have a bank account in Canada anymore. I stopped having a bank account in 2016. I had TD and a few other banks shut down my bank account on the same day, which was very suspicious. Three banks shut down my bank account on the same day because I was doing local Bitcoin transactions back in the day. Some people are able to literally get their payroll into Bitcoin, into bull Bitcoin, pay their bills, pay their rent, pay their friends. Also withdraw cash with a credit card. We don't have a debit card, but you can withdraw cash and an ATM with a credit card and pay it off with Bitcoin. If you want to live on the Bitcoin standard, check out our bill payment service.
Absolutely killer. Thanks everyone for stopping in. Great show. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Joey. Take it easy.
See you, buddy. That was great, by the way.